Okay, all you little screwies out there, I'm back with show number two, the Tasmanian Devil, back again to tell you how not to be a screwy in life, how not to get screwed by anybody, anytime, anywhere. I'm not doing this live today. They're going to broadcast it live later. I'm not exactly sure what that means. I noticed I may have mentioned before on watching late night TV, people come on and say, film before a live studio audience. My immediate response is, as opposed to what? A group of cadavers, a dead studio audience? At any rate, we're not going to be taking any calls because it's nobody knows I'm here, number one. So it's not going to be interesting. The interesting part of this show as we develop it, and this is show number two, is the callers who are calling in. And without the callers, it's just plain old boring me. But at any rate, just to give some background on what we're going to be doing, I've selected a few very short subjects on how not to get screwed. I'm going to first go into the category of jobs. That's important. Today, everybody's looking for jobs, except Congress. They seem to have their jobs. Obama, the government. You're not going to be able to do anything about it, so I'm not going to do a Rush Limbaugh or that other liberal guy and complain about the government because it's always been that way. It's been that way for hundreds of years. Isn't going to change, so you can talk all day and all night, and they're still going to have their money, and you ain't going to have yours. Let's start off with jobs. If you don't want to be screwed when you're looking for a job, one of the things that you really have to look at, you got to see through the crap. You look at the job titles. What do they really, really mean? I know years ago when some restaurant chain decided that $2.50 an hour, 40 hours a week, $100 paid to people who worked in the restaurant wasn't too bad, but they had overtime, which was killing them. So they came out with slots, job slots, called management trainees. Under the law, you give them a salary of $100 a week, which is the same $2.50 an hour times 40 hours. But then you get to work them another 20 hours, and you don't have to pay them that $3.50 an hour. And if you read the job description, my God, it had words like upward mobility and culinary expert and this type of thing. And basically what you did is flip hamburgers and scrape grease. And it got me to thinking, what are all these job titles? What do they mean? If you're a VP of marketing, a treasurer, the latest yuppie administrative assistant or admin, chef, accountant, contracts manager, account executive, technician, everybody's a technician. I call a DMV in California and they answer, Technician Jones. Really, what kind of a technician are you? Electromechanical, electronic, computer? No, he's just a clerk. More titles, research specialist, IT manager. Well, let's get down to it. Regardless of the title, all of the jobs have really only one or two of four general functions that you actually do day to day. So I think you can label all the jobs this way. Clerical, that's the most popular. Clerical, you're a clerk. The VP of finance of McDonnell Douglas is a clerk, plays with numbers and figures and writes things down and records them, whether he uses a computer or a pen and pencil, whatever. He's a clerk. She's a clerk. A highly paid clerk, probably $1,000 an hour or so, big title, fancy office, basically still a clerk. The accounts receivable girl down in the local Taco Bell or whatever operation is also a clerk, probably only making $10 or $11 or $9 an hour, but they're still clerks. They're both employees with the job earning a living. The next one is sales. Again, the high-end vice president of marketing selling yachts. This person is a salesman, a saleswoman, making probably quite a bit of money. But so is the clerk at Macy's in sales, more of a passive sales, making probably instead of $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 a year, more like $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000, but still in sales. So we have number one, clerical, number two, sales. Number three are what I call hands-on people. You're driving a truck, that's hands-on at some type of craft or skill or trade. A carpenter. I might even say that a sculptor doing statues is a hands-on person. Someone digging ditches. A skilled machinist. Again, all different levels. A skilled machinist might be making union $50 or $60 an hour. A rough carpenter, non-union, might be making $6. A local truck driver, $9 an hour, and over the road type might be making $40 or $50 an hour. So we have clerical, sales, hands-on. The last one I'm going to call design or creative. An artist used to be called a craftsman, but they're more design or creator. A department store window dresser is creating. An attorney who's in litigation, and there's very few of them, probably less than 1%, has to be creative. Engineers of certain types are creative. A design engineer is creative. Other types of engineers aren't. So basically, when you're looking out there, say, what am I going to be doing? Am I doing clerical work, sales work, hands-on work, or design or creative work? Check it out. Very rarely do you have a job that has even two of those duties. What am I doing here talking? Am I creating? I had to create some things and write some things, so I'm doing that. I also have to write it up myself, so I do a little clerical. I don't know what I'm doing in sales. I don't think I'm doing anything. And hands-on, forget it. The producer handles all that. So the big title doesn't mean anything, except if a lot of money goes with it. But you're still just a clerk. The executive administrative assistant is a clerk. If you get a reserved parking spot, it makes it better. Everybody seems to want a fancy title. The old typist became a typing clerk, became a secretary, who became an executive secretary, who became an administrative assistant, who is now an executive assistant. Still, really, what are they doing there, clerks? I mentioned executive secretary. I'd like to touch on that title for a moment. The real business definition of an executive is an individual whose daily routine decisions, things he decides or she decides every day, those decisions can affect the actual physical viability of the enterprise. It can survive, it can go under. That usually pertains only to what I call the top dog. Again, whatever his title is, president, COO, chief operating officer, CEO, chief executive officer, but not the HR manager or the purchasing manager or the administrative manager. Those are not executives. I want to make that clear. I'm getting tired of that term being thrown around. Everybody's an executive. Executive, to me, is how much you make. So everything is just nonsense. Sewer workers today are subterranean sanitation engineers. Gas jockeys are volatile liquid transfer specialists. What's a ghetto blaster? Mad Magazine once said it's an urban acoustical entertainment device. So we're getting caught up in all these silly titles. Why? Maybe to mask the fact that we're unhappy. We think titles are going to do it. So don't let yourself get screwed by the title. You'll imagine all kinds of things. Those ads are designed to make it sound like you're reaching nirvana. You're going to have everything you want. And it just doesn't work that way. So remember, look at it really. How much is clerical? How much is sales? How much is hands-on? And how much is design and creative? Now, still in the job category, am I boring everybody yet? Let's get into, let's get into pyramid schemes. Bad word, pyramid schemes. Pyramid schemes became along the way multi-level marketing. I think they had a few other names along the way. Now, I once took all the figures, which I'm good at, all the numbers from an outfit called Amway, which I call Scamway. And this is back many years ago in an article that was written by Amway, inserted into Reader's Digest or Reader's Digest. And basically, they gave their numbers over the years as to how many people they recruited, and then later on how much business they did, and later on what percentage was paid out. And I'm pretty talented at one little thing, seeing through all the nonsense and putting it together. So I got out my little pencil, and I don't think we had calculators in those days, and did some arithmetic, and I found out that only 1 out of 33,000 people, according to their own figures, ever made a living at Scamway. Okay? There's others today, Herbalife, or some version thereof. They seem to redesign them all the time for each new generation of suckers and change the titles. They're looking for screwies, but they're still just a pyramid scheme. The people at the top get all the money. I once looked at one called New Skin, and they were bragging after 8 or 9 months that they were doing so many hundreds of millions in sales, and they had so many representatives. And I figured it out that it worked out to $2.50 per month per representative. People lost millions of dollars in these schemes. Don't become a screwy to an MLM. As I said, the odds are probably 1 in 30,000 of even earning a basic living. The average expense of time and travel and emotion and the failure that comes with it is enormous. The average loss of money is about $3,000 or so. That may not mean much to you, but $3,000 means something to me. In addition, they're kind of like born-againism. They each reaffirm each other's love and need and desire, like a mutual society of support, and you become what we call an MLM junkie. They will go from one MLM to another forever. And each one is the new one that is different than the exception. And with each one, they lose a little more money and a little more time and emotion. And the sad part is that they're missing real opportunities out there. Eventually, some of them just give up in despair once they admit, which few do, that they have been had, they have been screwed by some wonderful, positive, friendly people. There is nothing more disgusting to a real businessman than to sit in a hall with a bunch of these people and listen to the pump-them-up stories by a bunch of BS artists who, with a few exceptions at the top, I'm not even covering their expenses. I've heard it all. Just take my word for it. Multi-level marketing by, in you know, any other name, pyramid. God, I can't remember off the top of my head. There's been so many names for them. You're not going to make a bunch of money. Or you can if you're one out of 30,000. I know that if you've already been bitten by the MLM bug, you're going to think I'm a crazy and I'm a bad guy. Because once you're bitten by the MLM snake, the poison, and that's what it is, runs through the system rapidly and stays there for a long time. These scams get very popular during slow economic times. I've been observing them since way back many decades. I once actually joined an MLM to do a friend of mine a favor and almost lost $10,000. I personally have never known anyone who joined an MLM and earned a living at it. If it was that easy, I guess we'd all be millionaires. Anyway, that's enough about jobs. I'm boring myself here. Let's go along to business. One of my favorite things in business is the get-rich-quick ads. I really, really, really love those. They are just so inviting. Of course, I always wonder when I read a get-rich-quick ad that says, "Hi, I'm wealthy, I'm going to make you rich as well." Why did this guy get off of his yacht in the Caribbean, leave the golf course, travel back up to his yacht club on the Hudson, and put an ad in some media somewhere offering for $39.95 to tell me his secrets and make me rich? You got to think like that. You can call it cynical. I call it being realistic. Get-rich-quick ads are very simple. I'm rich. I'm going to make you rich. Now, the funny thing is, when I call there, I expect to hear some type of executive secretary with an English accent, because this man is making so much money, he really, really, really needs those tax write-offs. Otherwise, he's going to give it all to Uncle Sam. But I don't get that. In the old days, I got a $19.95 answering machine that barely functioned. Or I'd get an answering machine saying, "Corporate offices, international." Actually, that's usually a room in a shared suite that they're paying $100 or $200 a month for. That's usually a female voice. The male voice always says, "Corporate executive offices." Could be a phone booth at the Greyhound bus station or Trailways, whichever one is still available. Again, if these people are so rich, why don't they have a secretary or receptionist as a tax write-off and to assist them with spending all their millions of dollars? So when they claim to be rich but can't even afford the basics of an office staff, this dumb old country boy begins to have serious doubts about their success, and so should you. Demand references from these people. Now, of course, when you get references, you don't want to be speaking to their cousin in Phoenix or their mother-in-law in Dallas or a paid singer. A lot of these people employ what we call singers. They're paid to sing the praises of how much money they've made or how great the product is. You got to do some really due diligence. Get on the internet and just throw it in, see what happens. You'd be surprised, and maybe you'll save yourself some money. What else do we have here? Somebody wrote me a note that says, "Hey, with MLMs, you'd be better off to buy a lottery ticket." Let's see. We covered jobs and multi-level marketing. Forget that. Let's go over to legal. I'm an advisor to people who have consumer issues. I've been doing it for 10 years, and I've worked with many, many, many attorneys. When I first became associated with this group, we had contracts with what are called independent contract panel attorneys. Somehow or another, businesses and seniors are part of a group that receive certain benefits and certain discounts in return for paying annual dues. And I noticed very quickly that these members who were paying to be treated nicely were being screwed by the attorneys. Now, if anybody ever wants to argue with my statement that 99% of the attorneys give all the rest a bad name, I'll challenge them to look at the data and research we've done here. So this is about how not to get screwed by attorneys, which is almost impossible because they're part of the legal industry with the judges and clerks and cops and guards and probation and parole and bail and all that type of thing, which is a huge industry in America, passing laws that are meant to generate revenues. Even the Supreme Court said cops aren't supposed to provide for public safety. They're there to enforce the law. And if laws they enforce produce money to pay the cops to support the legal industry, it goes round and round. But we're just going to deal with the attorneys and how to beat them. When you, or if you have a company, need the services of an attorney, you should ask an attorney the following before you give him any money or sign any agreement. And anybody that contacts me, I'll send out copies of any of these things. First, what is your usual and customary hourly rate? Are you certified in this particular field if there is a certification in the state? What actions are necessary to resolve my legal issue? Without holding you to it, what is the worst-case estimate of the total cost necessary to resolve this legal problem? Do you require a retainer? And they love to get retainers. And never, ever sign a retainer that says retainer is earned when paid. That agreement means the minute you give the attorney money, regardless of whether he ever does anything for you, he's earned it. Now, yes, you can complain to the bar and they will settle off, but you're still going to be a screwee being screwed by the screwer or the attorney. Lastly, does this attorney send a detailed invoice for each action or out-of-pocket expense? Now, the reason I want you to go through this is because in the legal industry, the first goal of attorneys appears to be to get as much of a retainer as possible. There was a book written years ago, How to Outfox the Foxes, How to Beat Attorneys. A retainer is used up 3 times faster than if you paid for each legal action separately. In other words, if I could convince an attorney to pay for each item one at a time, such as, okay, I'd like you to send out a letter demanding money. How much is that? Well, it's $150. Good, fine. I can figure out he's got to go into the computer, hit a button, fill in the names. But because he's putting his name on the letter, he's entitled to $150. The other party doesn't respond or tells us to stick it where the sun doesn't shine. So I say, file a lawsuit, a complaint, a civil complaint. Well, he's got to prepare that. That's $400, $500, $600, $800, $400 filing fees, $100 to get a sheriff, constable, marshal, or process server to serve it. Fine. And it goes down through the process of answering the other side and all kinds of nonsense you don't want to hear about. And I end up spending about $3,000 or $4,000 for the trial. If that attorney cons you into giving him $10,000, he'll do the exact same $3,000 worth of work for you, but it'll cost you $10,000. So, try to avoid retainers. Okay? An informal survey in Southern California indicated that most attorneys seem to talk clients into giving them a retainer by doing two things. Number one, they speak legalese. Now, legalese confuses anybody not familiar with Latin. Latin is a dead language, which should have been buried a long time ago, but attorneys don't want to bury it because they can charge more money to interpret it and sound wonderful. They're going to let people appear to be stupid because they don't speak a dead language. The second thing they do, in addition to speaking legalese and Latin, is assuring the client, with no guarantees in most cases, that they can resolve your legal problem successfully. And that occurs much less frequently than you may think. Usually, and you've heard this before, at the end of the day, the two attorneys walk away smiling and making money, and neither side really gets what they want. Now, I'm going to leave the civil side, where you don't go to jail, the civil side of law, and touch on criminal, because everything is being criminalized today, and one of you folks out there may be charged with something criminal. That's where they basically hit you with everything in the world because the cops and the prosecutors have all the money, get you to plead guilty. Then they call you a convicted felon. Now look up the term convict. That means to be tried by a jury of your peers. A lot of people just cave in, innocent or not, because they can't fight, but you're still a convicted felon. Anyway, touching on how attorneys screw people, criminal attorneys usually begin by promising to fight to the death the charges against you. Okay? Then, over a period of time, when they've sucked up as much of the retainer and money as you have, they somehow change it to a plea bargain. And you end up paying anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000 for a plea bargain, which could have been handled better by an honest, competent attorney for less than $2,500. As a matter of fact, if he did it closer to the beginning and the DAs or who's ever prosecuting didn't have to go through a lot of trouble, you probably would have got a much better deal. I saw something, I don't know how true it is, that 98% of all federal convicted felons were people who basically took a plea because they couldn't afford an attorney or couldn't afford to keep going. Now, in the legal industry, the first goal of an attorney, as I said, is to get a retainer. The second goal appears to be to build up as many billable hours as possible to screw you. Here's how they build up billable hours. Number one, they perform actions that are totally unnecessary or irrelevant to your legal issue. And then they invoice you for those unnecessary hours. The second things they do is they perform actions that may be necessary or maybe even not necessary to your legal issue and then exaggerate the hours they worked. They're on the phone with opposing counsel for 5 minutes. Hey, Harry, how's your golf game? Great. What about the Smith case here? I'll see you in court on the 20th. We'll talk. That 5 minutes becomes a half hour at $300 or $400 an hour. The last one is they don't perform any action on your legal issue. They do nothing, but they fabricate the hours. Once back east, a bunch of us businessmen got together and found out that our attorney had billed us the month before, each of us in 1 week, an average of 35 hours, and there were 9 of us at the meeting. So he billed more hours than there were in a week. We caught him, we complained, and the boss slapped his hand. Typical. There was a survey by a website called www.legaltricks.com in 1999, that of all the hours invoiced by the average civil attorney, less than 40% were justified. The remaining 60% invoiced were irrelevant, exaggerated, or fabricated, just as I said they do. A 2001 survey in Southern California suggests that 81% of civil attorneys' clients either ran out of money or refused to pay any more money before their legal action was resolved. This means that if half of the remaining 19% who paid and went all the way, if half of that 19% of those clients who went all the way actually won their cases, then the average person going to an attorney has less than a 10% probability of getting what they want. Save your money, folks. Save your money. You're going to be screwed by attorneys. Let's move on to, here's one, has to do with the government. You can't do anything about the government. Here's one that you can protest about a little bit. A long time ago, there was a voice. If you listen carefully, I heard it back sometime decades ago, and the voice said, equal rights. I said, what are they talking about? Equal rights. Women don't make as much as men doing the same job. Well, that's terrible. I'm your average guy. I don't want to see anybody screwed out of money. Minorities weren't being hired, weren't being paid. Yeah, look, I don't care what color you are, what anything, as long as you don't bug me about it. If you're doing the job, you get paid. And the voice became louder across the land. Equal rights, equal rights, equal rights, civil rights. Whoops. Wait a minute. What? What just happened? I was on that train supporting equal rights, changed to civil rights. What is civil rights? Well, don't worry about it. Well, I didn't, and civil rights turned into unequal rights. Back where we started, just a different group of screwers and screwees. Now the minorities and the women are not going to be screwed anymore, ostensibly. Okay, so they are no longer screwees, and somehow they become screwers. You will give me a job, the government says so. You will keep me regardless of whether I can't do the job or not. And you will basically promote me. Now, the funny thing is, as with any groups of people, the ones that, there's an old saying, the squeakiest wheel gets the grease. All the very competent people who were being screwed over the years, women, minorities, and so on, they didn't really benefit by it. It was the incompetence that jumped in and grabbed it. So now, we're paying for that. We're being screwed because when somebody demands their rights, those rights have to come from somewhere, and usually they come from you. So when you start running into people demanding their rights, say, wait a minute, where are these rights coming from? Because if you don't ask that question, you're going to get screwed. Now, what else do we have here? Let's see. Consumer. Good God. What I don't have here is investment. I wonder what happened to my investment group. Consumer. We don't want to talk about that. Restaurants. Oh, this is one of my favorites. Don't pay for the privilege of paying. How did they ever sneak up on us and get us in the habit of paying for the privilege of paying them? I remember in 1959, as a young idiot, that shows you how old I am, I was in Virginia, and a real estate broker was explaining the term points to me. I said, point, what, a point of a knife, point of a needle? Oh, no, points as in arithmetic, points. He spent an hour. I kept asking questions and getting BS'd every which way, fancy language, esoteric terms. And finally, it came out that if I wanted to buy a house, they had found a new thing, or maybe it wasn't new at the time, I don't know, called points. Hi, you can give us a mortgage and we will give you money to purchase a house at 4%. However, you will pay us 2 points, which is really percentages. You're going to pay us 2% up front for the privilege of getting the mortgage and paying it. You're going to pay us for the privilege of paying. So a $100,000 mortgage, okay, would cost you 4%, but you would give them 2% or $2,000 in front. Now that $2,000 in front comes out of you, so that affects the 4%, which is no longer 4%. It becomes 4.1 or 3 or something. So you've been screwed again. And then, over the years, I watched with amusement, although I never got into the game, of you will be charged a credit fee for us to check your credit. $50, $100, $200. Trust me, people. I'm a member of Equifax, okay? And it costs me $2 or $3 to run a credit check on you, okay? That's all just another screwing. Go rent an apartment. They'll take 100 applicants, charge you $50 a piece. They've got themselves several $1,000s for doing nothing. Tell them to stick it. You're not going to pay for a credit application, okay? You can go out and get your own. Call me. I'll give you one for $10, and I'll still make a profit. So don't pay for the privilege of paying. The next thing they came up with, and the banks loved it, was an application fee. I once ran into a bank called Bank of New England, fastest growing bank in New England. I think it was in Providence, Rhode Island. And I got a girl slightly intoxicated who worked for them who took 5 applications a day back then, which would be about today different. She was charging $300 for an application fee, which would today would be at least $500 or $600. So she was doing 5 a day, taking in, let's say, $3,000 a day, $15,000 a week, and they had 70 of these people. We did a little survey, and we found out, now this data is old, but I'm sure it still holds true, that of all the mortgage applications where there is a fee, less than 17% actually resulted in the applicant getting mortgage money. These companies were in the business of charging fees for applications. Again, this information is old, but I still think it's true today. The ones that didn't charge, over 70% resulted in a mortgage. They were in the business of lending money. That's their basic job. These other companies couldn't make money doing it, so they screw you. Kind of like the airlines can't make money flying people, so they hit you with baggage charges and $200 to change a flight fee and all that type of thing. So, again, you are paying for the privilege of paying. Application fees, credit fees, points. Even outfits like Sam's Club and Costco. Maybe I'm stupid, but A, I don't want to pay them $150 a year or $50 a year for the privilege of going there and saving a few bucks if I buy stuff that I probably am not going to use. So again, don't be screwed by paying for the privilege of paying. One of the things that really gets me is a thing called a timeshare. I know I'm stupid, it takes me a while, but I don't get it. I'm going to pay, what, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 to own something, 1/50th, 1/100th, 1/42nd of something that in many states doesn't even have ownership recorded. It's not real estate ownership, and I get to use it, but I have to pay for it, and if I don't use it, I have to pay a maintenance fee. I don't know. Then when you go to sell it, nobody wants it. So again, paying for the privilege of paying. Here's another way you're being screwed. I'm waiting for the producer to come in and say, look, you're running out of time. The word security, for my security, everybody out there seems super concerned with my security. The first problem I have with these idiots, or maybe they're not the idiot, maybe it's their managers, is that the typical conversation is ludicrous to begin with. I received a call a year or two ago from the Las Vegas Athletic Club. I was paying them $25 a month after giving them a $100 sign-up fee, fool that I am. And I was traveling and I hadn't paid it. Oh, that's okay. I'm talking to a producer. You can get on, let the people know you're watching me. I like to be watched. At any rate, another boring story, but maybe it'll help somebody from being screwed. I received a phone call, you know, asking for me. I gave him my, said, yes, it's me. And we're calling about your bill. Okay, what about my bill? Well, we can't talk to you until you verify some information. Now, this is ludicrous. They went into their records, they found my name, they found my phone number, they called me, I answer the phone, I identify myself. They're looking for something from me, and that's how most people get screwed. They don't understand. These people are looking for things from you, and then they want you to somehow pay with something, your time, your money, whatever. So they asked me to verify some information. And of course, knowing a little bit about the English language, occasionally looking at a dictionary, I said, okay, give me the data and I'll be more than happy to verify it. Oh, well, no, you don't understand. You have to give it to us. I said, oh, I see. Then you are the ones to verify it. Well, no, look, moron, verify, dictionary. That means to attest to the credibility, veracity, accuracy of some information provided to you. Go home and tell your mother she raised an idiot. Hang up the phone. This is all for my security, a waste of my time. Okay? The next time you're on the phone with somebody and they start with that tired old BS, for your security, I have to know, stop them right there. Look, this is nonsense. There is nobody in your company, absolutely nobody, you or your company, that could begin to be smart enough to protect me or my security from any danger. I can protect myself and my security simply by determining whether you or your company are smart enough and legitimate enough and have a need to know what you're asking. So before we go any further, I want your real full name. I want your employee ID number. I want your direct dial or extension number. I want your job title. I want your manager's name. I want a name of the person, the top dog who runs the entire company, who is probably hiding in an executive office somewhere. I want to know how to contact you. And finally, I want to know what type of security systems you have to prevent some hacker from finding out what my wife's bra size is or my jockstrap size when he breaks into your system and causes me trouble. Turn it around. Stop being screwed. If everybody in America would stand up and do this, we wouldn't put up with this crap. Am I passionate? Yes. Here's another consumer one I absolutely love, okay, and I can send you articles on this. How to avoid problems with leases. It's simple, folks. Don't lease. When you lease anything, telephones, automobiles, trucks, alarm systems, the final cost will be between 30% minimum and 300% higher maximum than if you just bought it outright at the beginning. The guarantee warranty period for what you leased is usually very short. After that guarantee warranty period is all finished, it's over, folks. The service repair costs are usually 100% to 250% more than normal. Another problem with leasing is that the company who actually provides the equipment usually has a bogus, and I'm calling it bogus because it really is, a bogus lease company to handle the lease. So if you have any problems with the equipment, you still have to pay the bogus lease company. Believe me, I manage the business end of a law firm, among other little businesses I play with, and I see it all the time. Technically, legally, you could go in to buy an automobile from a company that has it. They're the ones that have it, a dealer, manufacturer, whatever. And they go to ABC Lease Company, which many times has the same name as the agency, the automobile agency, or whatever it is you're buying, and actually has the same address. But they're a separate lease company. And once you sign that lease, if that automobile is never delivered to you, if that automobile arrives defective and blows up all over the place, and you end up in court, most rulings by the judges say, I'm sorry, the lease has nothing to do with that other totally separate company that resides in the same damn building, many times with the same phone number, okay, many times with the same name except leasing is added. Therefore, you must pay the leasing company for the automobile, which you don't have, or which is sitting in your driveway with transmission fluid all over the place. Don't lease. Also, these leases contain all kinds of fine print clauses which give them the right to rob you blind with attorney's fees, penalties, interest, assessments if you try to get out of it because you do have problems with the equipment. If the lease company repossesses the vehicle or equipment using one of its many fine print clauses, it'll auction the equipment at a price well below the real value, probably to somebody they know, their mother-in-law, then greatly inflate the amount of their loss, and finally will add their loss to all the other charges. Don't lease. I remember we took over a small company years ago. We had a phone system that we had paid $21,000 on, before I arrived there, to this phone company for the phones in our office, and still owed them $9,000. Our warranty was up, and they were sending in half-butted technicians when we continually had problems, charging us some ridiculous amount per hour, so I stopped paying them. I called a friend of mine in the business, and he said that an updated version of equivalent to that system, only better, was available. Total replacement cost, $7,000. And I'm saying, wait a minute. We'd be paying $30,000 for this system? So, of course, they threatened me with death and damnation. I bought the new system. A year or two down the road, they sued, I countersued, and I think we settled for $150 or $200. Stay away from leasing, except in certain circumstances where you need something for a short period of time. It's a one-shot deal. Let's see. The housing market may be coming back. So we're going to discuss condominiums. Definition of a condominium. Whenever I mention condominium, something weird happens. People say, oh, they picture an apartment. They picture a duplex, a triplex, a quadplex. They picture a single story, a one story, a two story. They don't seem to understand, so I'm going to educate people so they don't get screwed with condos. Condominium is a legal kind of a real estate term. Its definition is this. A building or a complex of buildings of any type in which the individual living or the business facilities are located and are owned by individuals. But the common area, the grounds, the hallways, the recreational areas, the parking lots, are owned by all the individual owners on a joint basis. So a condominium can be, as I said, a single story, two-story, 10-story, 20-story, one-unit, duplex, quadplex, triplex. It can be an office building. In 2002 or 3, I think, I bought a condo in University Heights, an office condo in San Diego. Paid $150,000 for it, sold it 3 years later for $300,000. I'm a genius, 3 years. I'm not. I just had a realtor, one of the few who knew what he was doing and was involved in it and got me into it. Now, the problem is that if you go out today and you want to purchase a condo, remember, you are going to own that condo, and you expect that you will enjoy the same type of quiet, what's called quiet enjoyment and privacy, that you would in an individually owned home. The problem is this. Many of the condos today are triplexes, quadplexes, apartment style. Okay? And an individual home, a stick-built home, usually has some space between you and the neighbor, even if it's only 10 or 15 square feet, and it gives some measure of privacy. You may speak loudly within your home or play the radio at a higher volume or run your dishwasher or washing machine late at night or watch TV and so on. Well, the problem is with these apartment-style condos particularly, that's what they were. They were apartments. All the common walls, the ceilings, the floors were not constructed as a real individual condo unit built for that purpose of steel plate and or concrete with noise baffling material, fire retardant materials, moisture retardant materials, insect materials. Because those real condos with all those layers afforded you privacy, security, and you could make almost as much noise as you could in the separate individual homes. But these apartments, my God, you can knock on your wall and just call, Harry, what are you doing over there? So the homeowners associations are always, always concerned with too much noise, dishwashers, whatever. So when you go into one of these places, it's advertised as a condo, knock on the walls. Because if you're anticipating quiet enjoyment, the privacy, you ain't going to get it. You're paying one hell of a lot of money for nothing but a cheap apartment. Because when apartments are built, they're built as cheap as possible to ensure that the owner makes money. Check the building, make sure it was really designed as a private residence and was not originally a low or mid-level rental unit converted. Don't get screwed. I still have 5 or 10 minutes left. Consumer, again, how not to get screwed. Always get 3 written bids showing what the company is going to do and exactly what the total charges will be. I'm in court. I just missed a court date. I got to refile and spend another couple $100 suing U.S. Data Corp. I'm going to blast out emails for you, company in Omaha, Nebraska, who took me for $2,500 because I didn't get an exact detailed estimate and they didn't perform. I'll probably beat them in court. A lot of people are mad at U.S. Data Corp. They have an office in L.A., but they're out of Omaha. But before you buy anything, and I'm stupid, I should have done all these things first. I should have had 3 written bids. I should have found out how the company is licensed by the state, if they had insurance to pay you back if they goof up, if the insurance or bonding company's policy was still in force. I should have got the numbers from any state, county, or city licenses. If they were a corporation or LLC, I should check with the Secretary of State regarding who's running things. I could call a Better Business Bureau, but my opinion, my dealings with them is they're just an Al Capone blackmail operation trying to get small businesses to pay them. They have a very poor reputation among many consumers because they favor their paying members and practically blackmail other businesses who will not join them and pay their dues. Regardless of what you are buying, never give MIF money in front. do not pay for vehicle repairs, home improvements, appliances, whatever, until you actually have the product satisfactorily repaired in your possession and the item functions properly. So, generally speaking, get three estimates and mention to each one that you're getting three, and they'll tell you what their beef is with the other one. You may end up with three companies all telling you the other three are bad. I don't know. Let's see. Let's get on with this second experimental program, how to buy on the internet. I have to make mention of the fact that on program number one, I said that BBS Radio, who are the host for this, breached one of my mandates on dealing on the internet in that they didn't have their physical address. They reprimanded me by saying, yes, they did have their physical address, but as with most websites, which is playing Where's Waldo, you have to go find it. So I'm going to change that. I think a good website should say, this is our name, this is our physical address, this is our telephone number, and then have a cast of characters there. I think that that is true of almost all websites. PBS Radio basically seems to do what they say they're going to do. And I apologize for saying they didn't have their name on the website. They're just typical, and not blaming them, that they have it somewhere else. How to cancel a contract? I'll touch on that. I only got a few minutes left. If you've signed a contract and want to cancel it, the method which has been most successful for our clients is this. Put the date and your return address at the top of the letter of cancellation. Write on it, in accordance with the cancellation terms of your contract, I am hereby canceling said contract within the time period specified. Sign the letter and print or type your name as it appears on the contract below your signature. Put the contract number below your printed or typed name. Make three copies of the letter. Send the original via certified mail with a return receipt requested. Mail copy number one to your local credit bureaus and send copy number two to your local Better Business Bureau and put copy number three in your file. When the green return receipt comes back, staple it to copy number three. Now, I'm going to get off this because somebody's telling me I'm running short on time and mention something about legalities. I've been kicking around the legal business off and on for 20 or 30 years, fairly active as an advisor to consumers in the last 10 years. And I want to make a statement. You can go into an attorney's office. I don't care how expensive they are. I don't care how many witnesses you have. I don't care how long the agreement, the contract is that you sign, or the trust that you create, or the will that you get. Okay? The attorney will assure you once everything is signed and sealed and notarized and delivered and copied and recorded that everything is fine, nothing can go wrong. That is pure bunk. If it was true, we wouldn't have any attorneys or courts. The point is that whoever has control can do whatever they want. There's a very old saying, and I want to remind all of my listeners, all 12 of them, of the old saying, possession is 9 points of the law out of 10, or 9/10 of the law. People are being screwed all the time because someone else has control of an asset, some money, some vehicle. They take it, they do it. And every day I receive at least one call from someone that says, they did this to me. They can't do that, can they? And my answer is, well, evidently they can. They did it. Well, they don't have a right. Well, they probably do in the contract when you signed it, because they have all the rights and you have none, whether you're buying from Best Buy or Ford Motor Corporation or whoever. And even if they didn't have the right, they would take the right. because they have a lot more money than you. So be very, very, very careful of believing that even if a contract is in your favor, that it means anything. A contract is only as good as the integrity, ethics, and honesty of the parties agreeing to it. Get that down. Just a minute. Somebody's telling me it's time to get off. But I'm waiting for the producer to tell me it's time to get off, because he's the guy that pulls the strings. Okay, in closing, very simply, okay, don't put up with being screwed. Don't be a screwy. Stand up on your hind legs. Tell them where they can stick whatever they want. Remember that. I got to go, but I will be back with show number 3 in a couple weeks. Bye.